Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, an exclusive conversation I had at our Young Women's Leadership Summit with no advertisers, brought to you by Turning Point USA at our Young Women's Leadership Summit, Matt Walsh. Many of you love him and follow him, and he's terrific. We have a conversation. We ask the question, what is a woman? It's a phenomenal conversation. You are going to love it. Support the Charlie Kirk Show, charliekirk.com/support. Again, there are no advertisers in this episode, so just send it to your friends and encourage them to subscribe to the Charlie Kirk Show by pressing the plus sign in the upper right-hand corner. You can get involved with Turning Point USA today by starting a high school or college chapter at tpusa.com. That is tpusa.com. And also email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For personalized loan services you can count on, go to andrewandtodd.com. The wonderful andrewandtodd.com. So, Matt, I figured there's no better kind of venue to ask what is a woman.
Yeah, I think I've been to the Women's March, and they didn't know there, but I think this is probably a different crowd from the Women's March, so...
And no better two people to talk about what is a woman than two men at a women's conference?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, someone has to talk about it. That's the thing. That's the conversation someone has to have.
So, I mean, let's just start at the basics. Tell us about your film, and did you actually get an answer to your question?
Well, that's a spoiler. I can't give spoilers away right here on the stage. But we did get an answer. I guess I can't say what the answer is, but we did finally, after journeying across the entire world, I guess I will give it away. I finally thought to just go into the kitchen and ask my wife, and then she was able to provide the answer. So I went to Africa before I thought to talk to my wife about it. But yeah, it's been an incredible reception to the film so far. And this was, look, what I keep telling the left is that, because they're very upset about it, and they've been pulling all kinds of tricks to shut the film down. They had a DDoS attack, which I just learned what that is, but it's some kind of fancy technical thing where they try to shut down websites, and they did that to shut down the premiere, and it failed and everything. And of course, it only brings more attention to the film in the first place, so it all backfires. But what I keep telling them is that, you know, I've been asking, what is a woman? I was asking it on Twitter like 4 years ago. All you had to do was respond to my tweet, and none of this had to happen. But this is really all your fault.
So, Matt, I grew up in a time where the feminists weren't just clear about what a woman was. They were angry if you disagreed. Like, of course you know what a woman is. It's very clear. And in fact, that wasn't that long ago. I mean, we had Brett Kavanaugh. We had the Me Too movement, where not only was it, you know, you weren't allowed to disagree on what a woman was, but all men were awful and we could kind of distinguish lines. How do we get to a place where now, kind of in the zeitgeist and in kind of the popular culture, this is now somehow a question? How do we get here?
You know, it's something, it feels like it happened 5 years ago. I think a lot of people think that it kind of all of a sudden sprang out of nowhere. And I think probably 5, 6 years ago is when it made its way into the mainstream. But this is something, we get into this in the film, and a lot of people don't know the background and the history of this. But this is something that's been bubbling under the surface, making its way into the institutions in this country for half a century at least. And we get into some names that everybody should know, names like Alfred Kinsey and John Money. I mean, these are the guys, like, you can actually find the people who invented this stuff. They wrote things where they just came up with this stuff. For example, the term gender identity, there was a guy who just came up with that. His name was John Money, who also happened to be a pedophile, by the way. A lot of these people were.
Total coincidence, by the way.
Yeah, total coincidence, right, obviously. We know that gender ideologues have a great interest in grooming children, and it just so happens all this stuff comes from pedophiles. But yeah, total coincidence. That's a conspiracy theory. It started there, and then it made its way into the institutions, and it's like critical race theory, where they, you know, what we hear with critical race theory is Well, that's only in, they only talk about that in colleges. Well, yeah, it might start there, but then it goes from there down into the lower grades and down into the rest of society. And the same thing happened with gender theory, basically.
Yeah, but how did it get where the feminists used to be kind of the loudest part of the American left, and now they're either been neutralized or they've been silenced or they no longer have a seat at the table? That's what I'm still trying to figure out. And maybe it's just a matter of volume or what's most useful to the kind of current narrative or regime.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the consequence of intersectionality and the rules of kind of the victim hierarchy on the left, which is a very confusing thing. And I don't fully understand it myself, but there's a lot of jostling for position. And right now, anyway, the kind of uber victims are the trans people. And you have the most victim points if you're trans. And if you're on the left, you have to, if somebody with more victim points than you is making a rights claim, a claim to some kind of rights, you have to defer to them. And that's the position that women are in right now. Now, we should note that while many feminists have just gone along with this, and I doubt that any of them agree with it, but many of them have gone along with it, there is a core of feminists who, you know, are derisively named the TERFs, the trans exclusionary radical feminists, who have spoken out about it, but they've been just very viciously shouted down. And it is a small group.
Yeah, and especially you kind of look amongst the opinion makers, right? New York Times, Harvard, ACLU. There's no place for that in those kind of main opinion shaping institutions.
Can I say one other thing quickly about that too? Because one accusation that we've gotten since this film came out from the, I guess what they would call themselves gender critical feminists, the feminists who are actually opposed to gender ideology, they said, well, why didn't you have anyone on our side in the film? Why didn't you talk to any feminist? And the answer is, like, we tried to. We reached out to many prominent feminists who have been critical. I'm not going to name names, but many prominent feminists who are critical of the trans agenda. We reached out, and they wanted nothing to do with it whatsoever. So that's another way that this small group of feminists, they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot because they don't want to be allies with, like, the likes of me. So they leave themselves on an island, basically.
To try to save womanhood, right? Minor details. But this all kind of goes back to the main feminist complaint, though, right? Which is that men are going to oppress women. And so now that's exactly what's happening now, is men oppressing women. And so the entire thing seems so interesting and just kind of befuddling and puzzling. So obviously we have a women's summit here. We could define what a woman is. But the problem also, Matt, is in recent years, especially, the kind of nastiness that is now embedded in this discussion and this debate, it's almost become a value debate that you're an awful person if you do not accept that gender is nothing more than a social construct. And it almost, in some ways, and especially in recent months, I'd say in the last 6 months, it's almost become more intense than the racial debate, where that this is so important. Why is it that it gets such a preference? I know you mentioned the oppression Olympics and kind of the competition of whoever can be the most oppressed person, which changes on a day-to-day basis. But it seems like they see an opportunity here. What do they think that's going to get them?
I think the viciousness comes from a couple of things. First of all, how important this agenda is to them. It's not just about gender. And even the word gender has been expanded to include, you know, anything. There are people now, if you look on TikTok, people say, well, my gender is, what's the latest one? I'm cake gender. That's a thing now. I could be the gender of cake. Right. Why, we talked to someone whose gender was in the film. We talked to someone who identifies as a wolf, you know. So the term gender has expanded because it's not just about gender. This is actually about, this is the project of relativism. This is about having your own universe. And I ran into this, and I know you've run into it. Anytime you talk about anything with the left, you always run into this. And in the film, it was over and over again. Every conversation we tried to have, it always came back to, well, whose truth are we talking about? Whose truth? And I would try to say, well, we're sitting in the same room right now, right? So the truth that says we're sitting in the same room, I'm sitting across from you. So we obviously have some kind of shared reality. 2 + 2 = 4. We share that with each other, but they cannot concede that. I think one of the moments in the film that haunts me the most, although it's kind of funny when you watch it, but I'm still blown away with it by it. I was talking to just a normal person walking down the street. Well, this is in Los Angeles, so they can only be so normal, I guess. But talking to this woman, and she said, we all have our own truth. And I said, okay, well, what if my truth is that you don't exist? And then she looked me dead in the eyes and said, well, then I don't exist. Not a joke either. So I knew that women were being erased. I didn't realize they were erasing themselves so eagerly. But that's when someone is desperate to cling on to this relativistic idea, there is no depth that they won't sink to in terms of absurdity.
I want to explore that more with you. So that really is what it comes down to. The postmodernist, deconstructionist, that we can't agree that a line is straight because that's only your opinion that it's straight, is the main critique of Western society. Because who are you to say that Western society is better? Because there might be some aboriginal, you know, culture that we haven't really studied yet, and we're not supposed to ever believe, you know, in the fruits of the Enlightenment, or separation of powers, consent to the governed, or gender norms, because those are colonialist in nature. And first of all, it's a patently insane thing to believe, but isn't it kind of a luxury belief, though, Matt?
Yes.
And I believe you're familiar with the term, and just so everyone knows, a luxury belief is a hypothesis. I can't remember the guy's name. He's really smart. And his argument is that rich people no longer just buy rich, like wealthy things like yachts and planes, but they also buy beliefs. Mm-hmm. And that if you want to be really cool in upper society, it's not just how big your car is, it's how insane of an idea you discuss at a cocktail party.
Yeah.
And so you think about it, it's super rich people where it's not like, oh yeah, I have the new Porsche and a Gulfstream. It's also like, not only do I want to get rid of the police, I want to put them all in prison. Like, I'll drink to that. That's great. How much of this is luxury belief driven? I mean, like, lower middle class people aren't talking about this stuff.
Don't have time to think about it because you have real problems you have to worry about. I do think that there's a lot of just sort of boredom. So we can talk about the sinister things that lie at the bottom of this, but there's also just boredom. People sitting around that have the time to think about kind of navel gazing. This is what we do in the West a lot. We just sit around thinking about, I'm going to think about myself and how I feel about myself. And then we spend all this time just staring at our own reflections. And then we're shocked when people have anxiety and depression. Well, this is what happens when you spend your whole life, like, just go outside and look at a tree or something, or just walk down the street. Stop thinking about yourself for 5 seconds. But on the luxury belief thing, we tested this in the film, because you're right that the claim on the left is that the so-called gender binary is Western colonialism, and that if you go outside the Western colonial bubble, you'll find that they're all very progressive in their gender ideas. Right. And so that is why we went to Africa, because I kept hearing this.
I couldn't figure out in the trailer why he's in some African trauma. Like, what is the point of this?
Let me just clarify. We went to Africa, number one, to troll the libs. Like, that's the number one reason we were there.
That's true missionary work, by the way. Let me just be clear.
So, and we had security meetings before this Africa trip, and they said, you know, like, you're going into Kenya, it's pretty safe, but they've got terrorists there, you could get kidnapped, and it's like, it's worth it to own the libs. I will give my life for this cause. I will. Anyway, the real reason we went there was to test this hypothesis on the left, about whether or not it's true that the gender binary is a Western construct. And what we found is that, well, actually, when you get outside of the Western bubble, all there is the so-called binary. And they have never even heard of any of this stuff we're talking about in the West. And then it flipped into this really interesting thing, because we talked to the Maasai tribe in Kenya. And they live in huts that are made of cow dung, and they're semi-nomadic. They don't have electricity or anything. It's you know, they're living in the wilderness. And we're talking to them, and I'm asking them these questions about, well, can a man become a woman? You know, is it possible for a woman to have a penis? Can men give birth to babies? And they're looking at me in just utter horror and confusion. And they also assume that I believe this stuff myself. I never explained to them I didn't. Right.
That's the funniest part is that Matt's just staring at them, and they're starting to circle you.
Yeah.
Like, they're calling in reinforcements, and then they start weapons start emerging.
Exactly. They all had their they had clubs that they walked around with.
Spears.
But then I was in this interesting position where they were wanting me, and they were all very patient. Like, they were treating me like I'm a confused child, and they said, "We'll try to explain this to you." But then they wanted me to explain these ideas to them. And then it's actually very revealing when you try to explain an idea to someone who's never heard of it before. That's when you can really see if this idea makes any sense at all. Because this is someone who does not have any of the shared kind of frameworks that we do, none of the shared biases, none of that. And so you're starting at ground zero. Can I explain gender fluidity to this tribal community from ground zero? And the answer is no. It's just total nonsense. They don't even have the words. Like I'm talking to the elder in the tribe through a translator, and he doesn't have the word. I tried to get him to ask the tribal elder about non-binary people, and he says what? He doesn't have the words for that. So they literally don't have the words to even talk about these things. It's that far outside of their experience.
We'll keep chatting. I think we have a clip that I want to show from that, if our team could get it. Just a short clip, so if you guys could pull that up and tell me when it's ready. But Matt, that's so interesting, because that is, you know, a common critique. I go to Berkeley and Boulder, and you speak at all the same campuses as well, and they'll always say, no, the problem is the Western colonial framework, that if you break people back in the state of nature, and especially in tribes, is actually one they use, especially kind of the breakup of kind of colonial, or I guess colonial breakup of indigenous people in Africa, then there really is no such thing as these gender norms. And they repeat it with such kind of intensity that it almost takes you back.
And they also, they can make these claims because they don't think anyone will be crazy enough to actually go ask any of these people these questions. And even though I did this, the rejoinder now from the left has been, well, you only talked to one primitive African tribe. And I'm like, dude, you can go talk to some more yourself. Like, go ahead, bring a camera crew, find a different tribe in Africa, and ask them all about gender fluidity. And go ahead, prove me wrong. Because this is all an insular, like you said, luxury,
belief.
Uniquely Western belief, and also very modern, that is not shared by anyone. And that includes, by the way, some of these cultures where they'll claim, here's another one. They'll say, well, Native Americans have Two-Spirit, and they actually have added Two-Spirit to the LGBT acronym now, the ever-expanding acronym. They now have numbers in it now for 2S,
what?
For Two-Spirit, right. So that's what they say. They say, well, Native Americans, they have Two-Spirit, that's just like trans. Well, all you gotta do is take 10 seconds to Google this stuff, and you discover that Two-Spirit, that term was coined, guess when? 1990 is when they came up with that. It was LGBT activists, and they make it sound like this is something that the Cheyenne were talking about.
Or the Sioux or the Iroquois.
Right, right. Yeah, the Apache on the Great Plains in 1801 were like running around talking about their fluid genders. No, this is LGBT activists made this up recently and now are claiming that this is some cultural belief.
So I want to start to kind of participate in some thought crimes with you here. Does anyone want that? I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, let's do that.
So it's Pride Month, I guess, whatever that is. So why is it, Matt, let's start non-controversially and then we can go whatever direction you want. Why is it that all of a sudden that, you know, mental illness is associated with the other letters? Where does it fit? I've never heard a good explanation.
You're starting non-controversially with that question?
Oh,
that's the non-controversial. Okay, we're getting real. I think there's a couple things going on with mental illness in particular, is that for one thing, this has become, like, mental illness itself has become trendy and fashionable, and it's something that is. Are we applauding mental illness being trendy and fashionable?
They're agreeing with you.
Okay, all right. Yeah, go mental illness. So it's become this trendy, fashionable thing, and this is, I was first made aware of this, like so many other things, of Libs of TikTok, who, by the way, is one of the best journalists in the country. And she's posting these videos that this is a big thing on TikTok of people, especially young people, claiming that they have split personality disorder, and talking about their other personalities like they're people in the room with them, which, by the way, if that disorder exists, that's not how it works, okay, in the first place. But this just shows you something. This is another thing, that on the right we see that, and we want to say, well, that's just a sideshow. That's nothing.
That's right.
No, this is TikTok. This is where kids spend their whole lives. And so this is not nothing. And it actually shows you something about especially youth culture, where the more mental illnesses you can rack up, sort of the more social credit you have.
Yeah, so by the mental illness, I obviously meant, you know, gender dysphoria, transgenderism, all that, which is a serious mental condition. How did that get married into the entire now extended alphabet soup of LGBTQIA+? I mean, it's an increasingly, you know, confusing thing for people.
Yeah, it is. It's a good question. That's you can follow the process of this happening And there's, you have to look also at the psychiatric industry, and there's a lot of they're complicit in this, and that's they're part of the process where first you can see this process play out, where first there's something like we call it now gender dysphoria. I think before it was referred to as body dysmorphia. Now they don't use that term anymore. And the problem, I believe, with body dysmorphia, if that was the old term, is that it made it sound like there's something wrong with you. And the reason they emphasize gender dysmorphia now is that what they're saying is, well, the problem is how you feel. You know, that's the issue. It's like if you feel like there's an incongruence between your body and your true self, then your feelings are the issue, and we can fix the feelings by fixing your body. But anyway, what you find from the psychiatric community is that they take these things and they kind of legitimize them first, and then they're kind of introduced into the LGBT equation. This also happens, by the way, with not just mental conditions, also physical conditions, like the intersex is a great example. So now the new pride flag is the pride flag just gets uglier and uglier by the year, right? And now it's like it's just this hideous, gaudy thing with all these random colors
and symbols too.
And symbols. And the most prominent symbol on the whole flag now, the newest flag, the one that NASCAR tweeted out, because they're on the cutting edge of wokeness actually, is the one that has a purple circle right there. It's the thing your eyes home in on. And that's for intersex. So now intersex are the most prominent members of the LGBT. What do they even have to do with LGBT? That's a genetic deformity. What does that in the world have to do with being LGBT?
So I guess the answer is intersectionality, right?
Yes.
I mean, if it's...
So that's my 15-minute answer to get around to...
Yeah, okay. I mean, I suppose it's just... And then, but the whole idea of gay and lesbian is that I am a certain, you know, sex, and I'm attracted to that same sex, which does at least acknowledge binary sex. It doesn't kind of play into gender fluidity. And yet it all kind of gets mashed together, which I guess comes back to the general theme of the kind of intersectional argument. By the way, in the NASCAR thing, I'm wondering, what percentage of NASCAR's audience do you think is gay?
0%, but 0.001 maybe? I don't know.
I mean, who are they paying? At some point, you have to ask the question, this probably makes you lose your target audience.
Yeah. Well, it's also, it's an even smaller audience. What percentage of the NASCAR audience is gay and would fly the pride flag? You know, because that's not always one and the same, right? But this is what happens. And the problem is these corporations, they intentionally alienate 99% of their fans and supporters. And yet the 99% still give them their money. We're very loath to say, well, you know what, I'm not going to give you my money anymore if you're not interested in it. I mean, look, you know, this is off on a tangent, but Star Wars, okay? What's the new Star Wars show? Obi-Wan, right. Okay, so first of all, there hasn't been a good Star Wars story actually ever because all the movies are terrible. But thank you.
Yeah.
See, I knew I could get a group of women to agree with me on that one.
A New Hope is very good. Okay, let's just... Episode 4.
At best, the last good one was in, 1983. And everything
well, this
since
was
then.
Well, I think this was 78 A okay. New Hope came out. You could fact check me.
So it's been decades and decades. And then they come out with this Obi-Wan show. And they've got a character who's a black woman. And the fans hate her. And you can read their criticisms. They hate her because she's an unlikable character, poorly written and poorly acted. Not because she's black. But it's this kind of entrapment that these studios do, and they know they're putting these unlikable characters out there. The fans react to it, and then Star Wars turns around and calls their own fan base racist. And Ewan McGregor comes out and says, you know, the Star Wars fan base can get a little racist sometimes. So they hate you, and on top of that, they're putting out a bad product, and yet we're still giving them our money.
Keep your Hulu subscription. We hate you, by the way,
yeah.
Right? It's at some point it has to be... You know, kind of self-destructive. I mean, obviously it's self-destructive. And I know the Daily Wire is putting together some competitors to actually go after Disney, which is just awesome. And so I want to say on this, though, because, you know, I'll speak for myself. In 2014, 15, and 16, you know, Matt, if you and I had this discussion, I would have disagreed a little bit with you. You've been on the issue of strong social conservatism. I never was not personally, but I would say publicly, say, hey, I have my own personal views when it comes to marriage, one man, one woman, but I want to live and let live. And I kind of bought into that. I was naive, and I thought that, hey, we can kind of allow people to make their own choices, and the results are going to kind of just whatever they might be, and we can kind of have this mutual detente, right, where you won't reciprocate against us, and we can kind of live in this neoliberal utopian paradise. You were always kind of like, you're naive, you don't really understand what's going on here. But I think a lot of conservatives, and people in this room included, were probably had this view recently, especially like, hey, I know gay people in my life, and I don't want to come across as hostile, and I don't want to try to impose our morality on other people, which is an insane proposition to begin with. But that was kind of in the conservative narrative for years.
Yeah.
And you look at 17 and 18 post the gay marriage decision, it's as if the kind of LGBTQIA plus, let's just call them the alphabet mafia, okay? Mm-hmm. The alphabet mafia's activism has only increased. It's become with more intensity and with more venom.
Yeah.
And so can you kind of walk through that? Because I think a lot of people would resonate with what I just said, where deep down we kind of want to live in that live and let live country. It's nice. It sounds good. It's in some ways woefully idealistic. But it also is incredibly destructive and opens the gateway for these ideas and these activist groups to have a hold on our children, our society.
Yeah, it's always everything from the left is a sleight of hand trick. That's the first thing to realize. And so that's, as you point out, the first problem with the live and let live thing is that that was never their project as much as they claim that. And so it always follows the same trajectory where whatever the thing is that they're proposing or advocating, the first they say, well, just look, let us do our thing, you do your thing, just tolerate, right? Tolerance is it. And then that's not quite enough. Now it needs to be acceptance. And acceptance is not the same thing as tolerance, although they get grouped together. I'm accepting and tolerating. Well, those are two different things. I can tolerate something and not accept it. But now you have to accept it too. You have to, acceptance, affirmation are synonymous. And then even that's not enough. Now you have to openly celebrate it. And then even that's not enough, though, because the next step is you have to participate in it. And that is exactly what's happening with going back to gender ideology. Celebrating is not enough. You need to be a participant, which means that if I am claiming I'm a woman, you need to be a part of that charade. You are an active member of my self-perception. And if you won't do that, then you are killing me. You're destroying me. And that is always the trajectory, which is the reason why it's just we cut it off at the beginning and say, so, nope, no way.
I want to repeat that. That's super smart. And I hope everyone caught that, right? Because this is the cycle of neoliberalism. And this is why people are waking up is first it was you have to tolerate it, which was the tolerance campaign. And then you must accept it and then celebrate it. And then the final is
participate.
Thank you. And so what phase are we in right now? We're in celebrate, participate. Would you say kind of the bridge between the two, right?
Yeah.
Because it was almost like if you don't, you have to tolerate. And I think a lot of people would like, okay, fine. I'll tolerate it. Like, okay, sure. And then it was like, no. Now you must accept it. Like if you disagree with it, you're a bad person. And then if you're not in a gay pride, parade, you're a bad person. And now if you're not putting puberty blockers in school, you're a bad person.
Yeah.
And Matt, it seems as if that's a pattern that manifests itself in almost every single major issue that the media first pushes and then gets kind of pushed on us.
It's true. And the other part of the story to keep in mind is that we talk about the victim narrative, and it's actually very important to keep that in mind, because the other thing for the left is that they're advocating for things, they're pushing for certain victories, but they can never achieve the victory. It's very important for them that it can never be seen that they've actually been successful.
The struggle must continue forever.
Right. Struggle continues, which is why we're told now, like we elected a black man president twice. And now if you listen to the left, this country is more racist than it's ever been. So we actually, that's not a sign of any progress whatsoever. So they're always saying, well, let's do this thing and then we'll celebrate it. It's a sign of progress. We have a black female Supreme Court justice. Then the very next day, they're saying, oh, it's Jim Crow all over again. Well, then why am I even listening to you? According to you, no matter what I do, we're going to be racist and living in the medieval times, no matter what. So what's the point of even trying?
Yeah, and I think where you're starting to see kind of, at least from my personal perspective and my 10 years of doing this, kind of a renewed focus and energy behind this is that we remember the phases of tolerance, acceptance, celebration, and then participation. And at least for me personally, I'm like, okay, I was okay on the tolerance thing. I was like, not really okay on the acceptance thing. And now you look back, you're like, boy, I was played. Like, you lied to us. Like, we were trying to be good people and trying to build bridges. and now you're teaching four-year-olds about lesbian sex. Like, this is not okay, and we're not going to put up with this, actually. And you took advantage of our good intentions, and now you're trying to take over the entire society.
And that's a really good point on what you just said. Yeah. Taking advantage of people, taking advantage of good intentions, taking advantage of people who just kind of want to be polite is a big part of what the left does, and it really infuriates me.
That's what they did to me.
And right, but I don't have that problem because I'm not polite. So you can't take advantage of that with me. But that's not like you should want to be a kind of a nice person. And so this is one thing when we did the film, when we go out and we talk to just normal people on the street, and the thing that was so clear that came through in all these many of these kind of man on the street conversations is that these people are terrified. Like they're good intentioned. They don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. They've also been told now by all the institutions that if you say the wrong thing on camera, if you, God forbid, you say that only women can have babies on camera, your life is ruined. And so people have just been taken advantage of, and they've been intimidated. And that's what sort of intimidation, fear, it's what paves the way for all these things.
So I want to play the clip that Matt mentioned. So Matt, remind us, what country did you visit?
We flew into Kenya, and then we got into Nairobi, and then we got into these kind of very impressive SUV kind of safari vehicles. We drove about 5 hours down into the bush. By the way, what we find in Africa is they don't, at least in this part of Africa, they don't really believe in like rules of the road. So it's kind of a Western construct. Yeah, it is too.
Okay.
Although in many American cities, I don't believe that anyway. And we went down and we talked to the Maasai tribe down there.
All right. This is for you guys. Can go to dailywire.com. Actually, we have a promo code dailywire.com/Charlie to get a membership to watch. Let's watch the clip.
What if a man decides that his gender identity is woman?
A woman has its own duty, and a man has its own duty, and a lady cannot do the duty of a man, and a man cannot do a duty of a woman.
Can a man become a woman?
No.
No?
No.
What about a transgender? Transgender?
No.
No?
It look like to if you want to become a lady but you're a man, you have something wrong. Something wrong in your family, something wrong in you.
What about if someone was non-binary?
Come again?
Non-binary?
Uh-huh.
Do you know, like non... Like someone is...
You're not a woman, you're not a man.
Yeah, someone's like, someone is neither. There's something else. Is that...
He's saying we have never seen things like those. For a man, he has a penis. For a woman, he has a vagina. So we know this is a lady, this is a man.
What if it's a woman with a penis?
What?
People are laughing. Is that a dumb question?
Hey, I mean, they said it, not me. So that's what I love about that clip. I've just been having so much fun posting that on Twitter. It's like the thing is, the Maasai tribe, you can't kick them off Twitter, you know. And right, they're totally uncancelable. And it does create this really difficult situation for the left, in that, what are they going to do, dox the Maasai tribe? They don't even have fixed addresses, so, yeah.
They're going to show up and protest them in Kenya. So Matt, now I want to kind of talk about, further explore this tension that I know some people watching, they'll love the movie. I'm like, this is terrible, it's awful what's happening. And you talk to people that have performed these surgeries, chemical castration, genital mutilation. It's amazing content and totally eye-opening, even for someone that I considered myself to be kind of somewhat literate in this space. But some people then are hesitant to say, should we use legislation or government to then try to solve some of these things? And so how should conservatives think about that? Because I think you'll have a lot of consensus amongst the audience that, yeah, this is wrong, this is terrible, but who am I to say? Who am I to try to get involved in somebody else's business? Why should this be everybody's business?
The first answer I want to give to that, and this to me is important, and it's kind of for a lot of people it's like the third or fourth answer, but for me the first answer is that the truth actually matters, right? The truth just right. Because this is a response I got many, many times, which is, you know, why do you care? Why is it so important to you? Well, because I care about the truth, and the truth matters for its own sake. So let's just start with that. I mean, if there was a movement afoot to convince everybody that squares are circles, you know, and that geometry is fluid, and there's a square circle spectrum, and it's all the same, I would be fighting back against it. I would make a film called "What Is a Square?" because it's just true. I don't want to live in a world where people don't understand the difference. So that's the first thing. The truth matters. And I just think we need to reject this idea that we have to immediately go to the kind of like practical. Well, how is this practically affecting me? It does practically affect us. And that's when we bring us to the next thing, which is that women are, as you women have noticed, are being erased, appropriated. We hear so much about appropriation. Women's identities are being appropriated. And basically, like, womanhood is now worn like a costume. It's like something that a man can just put on. Right? Yeah. And being taken advantage of, being put in incredibly dangerous situations, you have women in prison now who are being locked in cages, right, with violent males who just say that they're women. In many cases, the man doesn't even have to take hormones or certainly doesn't have to get sex change surgery. Just a man says, oh, you know, I'm a woman, turns out. And they say, okay, we'll send you over to the women's prison. A lot of these women, many women in women's prisons have been sexually abused in the past. And just imagine that. So that matters. Okay. That's why we need legislation to stop that. And then also children. Listen, LGBT identification in general has, for the youngest generation, has risen 20-fold over their great grandparents. Okay. So for the great grandparents of Gen Z, LGBT identification, according to Gallup polls, is like 0.8%. For Gen Z, it's 20%. And if you follow the generations, and it's getting higher. And for my kids' generation, it's going to be even higher than that. It's probably like 40%, 50%. In fact, it will be 40%. I'll predict that right now. And here's how I know. Because for the last five generations, LGBT identification has doubled generation upon generation for five generations in a row. And I think that's going to continue. Trans identification in particular, also 20 times higher, especially among Gen Z. So there's this real conspiracy among all the most powerful institutions in this country to brainwash and indoctrinate and recruit kids into what is, I think, a cult, and to create within them an identity crisis. We're taking kids who are just normal, innocent kids. You have like a three-year-old boy who's just a normal boy. Anyone who's been around a three-year-old, you know, they just say a bunch of nonsense all the time. Nothing they say means anything. They're just like little kids running around talking nonsense. And so a little boy says, just one day says, oh, I'm a girl. And you have these adults that latch onto that and they say, okay, now, you know what, now, Johnny, this is going to be your life now. This thing that you just said when you were 3 years old because you were babbling, this is now your life. Like, this is now an identity crisis that we're going to create for you. And we're going to put you on the path to mutilation, despair, and suicide. That's why we should care.
So, and totally applaud that. There's a romanticism element to this too, which in a lot of the literature, they would always value the infant over the adult. And they would it's kind of an extension. We've seen it in recent years, and you've seen it in our education system where teachers kind of go around the room like, I'm going to ask my third graders what they think, you know, about gun control. Like, actually, no one cares about what your third graders think about gun control. They're in third grade. You should teach them things that are true. And teachers that do this, they have totally the wrong perspective of what education is. It means to lead children towards the truth, not to democratize it and be like, yeah, kids say the darndest things. Like, they actually say really dumb things, and you should correct them and tell them to sit up straight with their shoulders back and speak properly and use good English and get better handwriting.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, it's been this over-elevation of the child. And that's not to say that children can't say things of wisdom and they can't be cute and all of that. Obviously, there's a balance in between it. But when children start to dictate your public policy, you go in a bad direction. And guess what? We've done that. We've tried to do it on gun control. Remember Parkland? We decided to just listen to a bunch of teenagers about guns. We've done it with environmental policy. Greta Thunberg has become more instrumental than most scientists in the West. And it doesn't seem like it's any different, because there is almost this untouchability that American adults feel towards the nation's children, as if, who am I as a 55-year-old parent who pays taxes and has been around for multiple decades? Who am I to tell my 6-year-old what is true? How on earth do we get that messed up?
Well, one way is that the people coming up with these ideas are all a bunch of like childless cat ladies with purple hair who have, they've just never been around kids. They really don't even understand what a kid is.
Oh, that's exactly right.
Because listen, I have 4 kids, and you just have to be around kids for like 5 seconds and you realize how much nonsense all this stuff is. My 2-year-old, okay, so this is just one example of so many others. My current 2-year-old daughter, the youngest, has been insisting to us for weeks that there's a monkey in her room that only comes out at night when she's sleeping. And she tells us all these wild stories about this monkey.
Well, monkey pox or the monkey?
Well, I'm worried now. I'm a little bit worried. Yeah, I heard about monkey pox. So I got to talk to her about that. We might get the vaccine, I guess. So she's telling me all about this. And does that mean, is my 2-year-old, is she hallucinating? Is she crazy? Is she lying? No, none of that. Is there actually a monkey in there? Of course, that's not true either. It's just that kids don't have the distinction between fantasy and reality doesn't exist for young kids. That's the reason why, and I bring this up to the gender-affirming pediatrician I talked to in the film. You know, a 4-year-old kid, and I don't think there's no 4-year-olds here, right? So I don't want to spoil anything, but a 4-year-old kid, you don't even have to convince a 4-year-old kid of this. They'll just believe you the first time you tell them that there's a magical fat man who flies through the air on reindeer at the speed of light and brings presents to them through a chimney. And you could tell a 4-year-old that, and they'll just say, oh, okay. They don't ask any skeptical questions at all, like none. Because it just doesn't, the idea that, you know, of invention and imagination and fantasy, that doesn't exist for them, because their whole world is imagination and fantasy and all of this. And that's what's so wonderful about being a kid. Just like, let them have their imagination. Let them live in this innocent, childlike world. Stop trying to turn it into this, you know?
But it also is incumbent on adults to say stop when the line is crossed.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's, and we know this, because as you grow older, you realize true freedom is not doing what you want to do. It's the pursuit of virtue. I mean, go meet an alcoholic. Are they free? Of course not, obviously. The alcoholic did whatever they want to do whenever they want to do it, and they're the least free people in the world, and they have to struggle very hard to get over that. And I think all of us know people in our lives that struggle with that. That's a very serious thing. And so when you're dealing with a child and they all of a sudden kind of cross a line, the moral society loves the child so much to say, we know what's actually better. Stop eating dirt, right? You have to not only eat sugar. I mean, these are very basic things that we are willing to do. And yet, Matt, it's insane. If I were to say, okay, if a child just says, I want to eat Skittles for the rest of the year, no rational adult would say that's good. They would say, you know, called child protective services almost. And yet, if they were to say, if that 5-year-old would say, okay, I'm fine eating broccoli. I actually just want to have my genitals chopped off.
Right.
The parent says, oh my goodness, tell me more. That to me is kind of the most obvious component. I agree with you partially, Matt, but I want to have you explain it for me a little bit more, because you're right. A lot of this is like sexless, childless, you know, purple hat, purple hair people that are really angry, but there are parents that go along with this.
Yeah. Definitely.
Can you help me understand that?
That's true. I think the people and kind of the institutions and academia who are coming up with these ideas and filtering them down, you know, these are the childless purple haired people. Yeah. And they do almost always have purple hair. It's just like crazy how that's, how
the
it works.
The opinion makers, right?
Right?
Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, when you get down into it, when you filter beyond the institutions and get into the family, unfortunately you do often find now parents who are eager to go along with this. I think when it comes to parents of so-called trans kids, and I say so-called trans kid because there's no such thing as a trans kid in reality, but the parents, I think they kind of broadly fall into 2 categories. The one category is the parents of the adolescent, and Abigail Schreier talks about this all the time, wrote about it in her excellent book.
Irreversible Damage.
Irreversible Damage, yeah. So these are the parents who you're raising your kid. You're doing everything you think right. You're loving your child. And then one day your daughter comes home at the age of 14 and says, I'm a boy. I want to chop my breasts off. And the parents, of course, react like any parent should and say that I'm not going to do that. But then oftentimes a parent make a mistake, and it's unfortunate this is a mistake now, where they go to a therapist without doing a lot of research ahead of time. And the therapist tells them, well, do you want to have a living son or a dead daughter? Because your child's going to kill herself or himself if you don't allow this gender transition. And there are parents that are, I mean, imagine hearing that when you're not prepared, you don't really understand, you know, you haven't looked into this very much, you didn't expect any of this, and then all of a sudden you're hearing this.
That's a threat, by the way.
That's a threat. It's emotional blackmail.
Totally.
And so I have a lot of sympathy for the parents in that position. Although, no matter what, you cannot ever go along with your child mutilating themselves, no matter what. But that's different. That is different from the parent who says, my five-year-old is non-binary. That's a totally different thing, okay? Because your five-year-old, this is not institutions conspiring against you. Your five-year-old can't put any pressure on you. This is something, your five-year-old didn't come up with that. No five-year-old comes up with that. You came up with that, and this was your idea, and you put them on that path early in life because you wanted a child who was non-binary or trans, because they're a prop, they're a political pawn, they're a fashion accessory that you can carry around and show off, you know?
I want to play a clip from the movie of how real this chemical castration is. I think this is the clip you were talking about, Matt, so let's take a look.
At what age does the medical transition begin with medication?
So medical affirmation begins when the patient says they're ready for it. So that could be a kiddo who is just starting puberty and panicking because they're getting breast buds or their penis is getting bigger and busier and they're worried about all kinds of masculine changes. And that way, puberty blockers, which are completely reversible and don't have permanent effects, are wonderful because we can put that pause on puberty. Just like if you were listening to music, you put the pause on and we stop the blockers and puberty would go right back to where it was. The next note in the song just delayed that period of time.
You can just pause puberty.
No, you can't.
And then pick it up?
No, you can't.
For the future?
No, you can't. How many studies do they have, long-term studies, on hormone blockers with children? None.
I just spoke a month or two ago with a mother whose 14-year-old daughter was put on blockers. They discovered after 2 years, this 14-year-old girl has osteoporosis. That's something that, like, old women get.
How can doctors assure parents that a certain medicine is totally safe? If, based on what you're saying, they can't possibly know that.
How can they be removing the healthy breasts of 15-year-old girls? How can they be sterilizing kids? How can this whole thing be happening, Matt?
So, can you just reemphasize one of the points? Puberty just can't stop like it's a movie, right?
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. It's a healthy process in the human body. And as you heard from Scott Nugent, who's a woman who transitioned to a male, although she says in the film, she's one of the only honest people we talk to, and she says, I transitioned to appear like a man, but I'll never be a man. Anyway, as we hear from her, that there are no studies that have been done on this whatsoever. We've never had a generation of kids that has had this done to them. Like, they're lab rats. So we're just kind of trying this out on a whole generation of kids. But based on what we do know, we know that these are serious drugs. A little bit later in that same interaction, we talk about what the actual drug is. The actual puberty-blocking drug is Lupron. That's what it's called. And it is used off-label to, quote, block puberty. It is actually a cancer drug for prostate cancer that you give to adult men. And at a certain point, they realized it had chemical castration properties, so they started giving it to sex offenders to chemically castrate pedophiles. And now we give it to 12-year-old boys. And I asked that pediatrician about that, said, Lupron, that's chemical castration. And that's when she said she wanted to get up and the interview was going to be over. She didn't want to talk about it, but it's absolutely true. And this is what we're doing, not just to a couple of kids, but to thousands, millions of kids.
Yeah, so that the question is also, how widespread is this, right? We know the pharmaceutical industry has done such damage to our country, especially over the last couple of years. I mean, you want to look at kind of one of the major enlightenments is how people don't trust Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Moderna anymore after the damage they've done. But this is an interesting wrinkle where people don't realize it's not just the pharmaceutical companies that are pushing antidepressants on you unnecessarily. And by the way, they might make your depression and anxiety worse, just so we're clear. So be very careful before you go on benzodiazepines or Prozac or Xanax. But it's not just that, but the pharmaceutical industry is involved in this trans issue. There's billions of dollars to be made in new FDA-approved puberty blockers, and then with it, the benzodiazepines and these other drugs that could also accompany it. Talk about the pharmaceutical profit motive involved in a lot of this.
Well, as you just said, billions of dollars. And anytime there's billions of dollars involved, then we know that that's reason enough for skepticism. When it comes to chemically castrating kids, that should be the entire reason that you need to be skeptical of it. But there are people that are making billions of dollars, and it's not just the pharmaceutical industry. This goes to therapists. You know, there are therapists that used to just be regular old therapists, and then they realize that the real money is in the gender affirming game. And that's where you can really make the money. That's where you can find all the clients. And so this is all they do now, is they do gender affirming care. And then there are, you know, endocrinologists who, this is all they do now, is give out the hormone blockers and everything. There are people who have realized in therapy, psychiatric industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry generally, that there is lots of money to be made here. And so they have no incentive. You know, if you've got a 5-year-old boy who has now had this gender confusion foisted on him, there's no profit incentive in helping that child overcome the confusion and just live as a boy. I mean, that boy, there's a dollar sign over his head. That boy is worth millions of dollars in the long run to lots of very powerful industries.
It sounds cynical, but boy, we believe it after the last couple of years, don't we? After we've seen what they've done to us. So, Matt, how much do you think of this as natural predisposition or societal fad? Because this is an ongoing debate that I will say that mostly adults over the age of 50, they'll say, look, no one wants to be transgender. No one wants to be gay. And believe it or not, this is actually mostly boomers make this argument, believe it or not, that no one would wish this upon themselves, because I think they remember a generation where that was true in the 60s or 70s or 80s. But as you say, and I don't say this jokingly, it's just true, it's the gayest generation in history. You know, 40% of according to Arizona Christian University, 40% will identify as bisexual, lesbian, gay, or, you know, any one of those categories. And I didn't believe the study at first. So we asked our podcast audience to email us. We received thousands of emails. And they said that, oh yeah, like half of my child's fourth grade class is non-binary or lesbian or gay. Do you believe 40% more or less? Would you find that? Just the audience. Do you think that's about right? Yeah, heads are nodding. And so how much of this is predisposition, Matt, such as a, you know, there might be something for whatever reason of feminine or masculine tendencies for a man or a woman, or how much of it is a fad? And are we even allowed to say that?
I think almost all of it is a fad. There's a very small minority of people who, even apart from any fad and any of this being suggested to them, would have some confusion, some delusions about their true identity. And if you want to know what percentage that would be, well, just look at the generations before any of this was promoted or suggested or advertised. And if you go back to like our grandparents' generation, it's like point something percent that would have identified as trans. That's the number. That's the number of people who have the mental condition, and the rest of this is societal.
I don't mean to interrupt, but just to say, because I'm sure a lot of you receive that counter argument. Well, they'll say, oh no, but they weren't comfortable coming out back then, so the environment is different. I'm sorry to interject, but I'm sure a lot of you have heard that argument. How do we respond to that?
Well, what do they always say? They say that if you don't affirm somebody as trans, then they're going to kill themselves. You're creating suicide, right? We've all heard that a million times. Okay. Well, hold on a second. So back in 1950, let's say, there's 0.01% identifying as trans. But in reality, there's like 10% trans, but they're not being affirmed. Was there an epidemic of people killing themselves in 1950 because they weren't being affirmed as trans? Did that happen like at all? Ever? So that's my response. It just, the whole theory breaks down. According to them, if that's true, that in 1950 there were 10% trans, but they weren't being affirmed, then there should have been a mass suicide epidemic. That didn't happen. The mass suicide epidemic is now. The mass suicide epidemic is alongside the affirmation. That's what's causing the suicide.
And so it's the exact opposite of what they're saying.
Yes.
And so a lot of people, so this is an interesting component. I think this is a good way to end this, which is what do we actually do about it? So I think the frustration that people have about this issue is that 99% of America does not believe men can become pregnant. Maybe less, 90%, I don't know. 99% of America think this stuff is insane. All the while, 99% of America is afraid to talk about it, which is that there's an incredible, and we mentioned this at the beginning, there's a bullying, a harassment, intimidation, a threat, and a fear around this issue. So, Matt, give us a status report. Who's winning? Is the Alphabet Mafia winning? Is it, you know, the cartel of chemical castration? Are we starting to gain some ground? Do you see some promise? Are you more optimistic? Give us your report.
They are winning right now. We have the statistics. We talked about the numbers. It's clear that right now they're winning. But this is why I'm not usually optimistic on anything. So if I'm optimistic on something, then it's there's reason to listen. I am actually optimistic on this. I think that we're not winning right now, but we can win. Okay, gender ideology is pervasive, ubiquitous, incredibly toxic and harmful and dangerous, and it's beatable. We can easily beat it. And I discovered this myself filming this documentary because all I did, I went around and I just asked the simplest, most basic questions. And what I discovered is that this is an ideology that is so weak, so flimsy, so utterly hollow at its core that it cannot withstand the pressure of even one genuine question asked with real skepticism. All you have to do is just stand up straight, confront this thing, look it straight in the eyes and ask it questions. Demand that it explain itself, okay? If you're going to come to me with this gender ideology thing, explain it. Tell me why I should accept it. Answer these questions. And they can't do it. They just fall apart. So we can win, but we have to have, if we're not willing to actually stand up and ask the questions, then we're not. I mean, we'll require some a little bit of courage. You know, there's no way to win any fight without some courage.
And remember that spectrum, which I thought was brilliant, right? Which goes from tolerance, acceptance, celebration, and participation. One leads to the other, and we're now on that bridge between mandatory celebration, that if you are not showing your flag outside your door, or if you're not showing your participation in it, then you're going to be docked points. But let's develop the battle plan here. We have a couple minutes remaining here. Matt, what are people to do? What are our Turning Point USA activists supposed to do? What is the everyday person supposed to do to actually fix this? Because there's a lot of angst and unease. This is in the schools. This is in the corporations. This is in mass media. And people are afraid to, yes, speak out about it, but it also just seems overwhelming and intimidating. So what is an everyday person supposed to do?
I mean, the first and most basic thing that we could do is just go out and kind of live your life as a normal, rational person and refuse to surrender. Yeah. Just if all of us in this room were to agree to this right now and make this pledge, like as a starting point, that we are going to be normal, rational people living in reality and we will not surrender that or compromise that for anyone. Doesn't mean we're going out and shouting in people's faces. I'm just going about my day and I live in reality and that's where I live. And I'm not going to pretend otherwise ever for any reason. If we just all lived like that, then that's huge progress right there. That's the first thing. And then we also have to talk about the kids too. And, you know, if you have kids, we have to think about ways that we could protect our kids from this. One big way, they're practical things like, you know, don't give your 8-year-old a smartphone with internet access. That could be one thing. Give your kids, your kid needs an oasis, a respite, a break from the culture and the madness. You have to give them that, like, and they might not want it. They might not know that they need it or even know that they want it. So you have to kind of force it on them. By taking the phone away, taking all the stuff away, and just saying, you're going to be here now, present in the home, go outside and play, be a kid. That's another thing that we have to do, because we have to, you know, put up this barrier protecting our kids so that we can kind of stop this pipeline that's getting all these ideas out into public.
And I would add a couple things to that. I mean, I want to reinforce the courage part, by the way. It's hosting the Turning Point USA events, doing the activity on campus. And by the way, who would love to bring Matt Walsh to campus? How awesome would that be? Wouldn't that be amazing? We tried to make it work. Berkeley would have been a lot of fun. We'll get it done. I'll tell you what. Could you imagine Matt and I going to Berkeley? Woof, that would have been something. We'll get it done.
We could play the Africa clip at Berkeley.
Yeah, that would be something. I'll tell you what. boy, that would Boulder too, and a couple other campuses. But I want to add to this, and I know, Matt, you will agree. And this is something as conservatives we don't like to do, which is we have to make the cost of harming children high. What do I mean by that? We have to punish these people. We have to be unafraid to entertain laws, entertain public policy, and yes, also social stigma. If you are involved in the proliferation or the normalization of chemical castration for children, like, I'm not going to tolerate that. I'm not going to accept it. In fact, there has to be a cost associated with that, because that's exactly what they've done to us for years. Matt?
Hey, amen to that. That's I wish I had led with the punishment bit. That's a lot more hardcore, and I like that. But I think you're exactly right. We have to actually be we should feel angry. Like, you couldn't, it's, yes, it'd be impossible to be too angry about what they're doing to kids. And if we don't feel that anger, like, viscerally, then that just shows that it's been normalized for us. We've been desensitized to a certain extent. That's not okay. This idea that we should never be angry about anything. We should be angry about this and act on that in the way.
Righteous indignation. So, Matt, I have a personal question for you. How does your faith play into this, if at all?
I mean, my faith, I'm a devout Catholic, so obviously my faith lies at the, yeah, there we go. There's a good applause line. My faith is at the foundation of everything that I do and believe and think. However, I would also add that although I'm a devout Catholic, I don't think that you need to be a Catholic or a Christian or religious at all to realize that men can't have babies and that all this gender ideology stuff is crazy. Actually, the religious faith when it comes to gender ideology is on the part of the gender ideologues. That is a very faith-based position, and I think it's important to keep that in mind.
They are the fanatics.
Yeah.
They're the zealots. They're the ones that believe in the flat earth or some sort of undefined hallucinogenic sky god, right? Yeah. They're the ones that believe in the things that can't be proven, can't be articulated. All the accusations that they give against religion, they're the ones that actually believe. There's far more archaeological evidence for the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ than for any of this transgender nonsense. Not even close.
Absolutely.
And I have a soft spot for Catholics. Closing thoughts, Matt.
Well, I hate to end on a sales pitch, but I'm a dirty capitalist pig, so I have to say that if you like what you saw in the film there, you know, we put a year of our life into this film. I do think that it's actually important. It can make an impact in the culture. That's why we did it. And so I would urge you to, you know, subscribe to the Daily Wire, watch the film, share it with your friends. It's something I'm really proud of. The whole team is proud of it. And I think it can make an impact. I hope it will. So become a subscriber today. That's my final word.
I will close with this. Matt has a super busy schedule. This was a last minute addition, but he thought so highly of all of you and wanted to be with all of you, and no better place to do that. So give it up for Matt.
Thanks, everybody.
God bless you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Email me your thoughts as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thank you so much for listening. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.